So next is the matter of J. Michael Farrell. Why don't we, for the record, just get appearances, please?
Yes, Deputy Ethics Counsel Hillary Horton on behalf of the Office of Attorney Ethics.
Good afternoon. J. Michael Farrell, pro se.
Thank you. And Mr. Farrell, Ms. Horton traditionally goes first, but I wonder if you could clarify something first. I understood that you did not oppose disbarment in this case. Is that still true?
I believe that'll be the gist of my preliminary statement, yes.
Very well. Ms. Horton.
Yes, may it please the court. We're here this afternoon following a motion for final discipline. Once respondent was found guilty after a 14-day jury trial in the United States District Court for the District of Maryland to 10 offenses, including money laundering conspiracy, tampering with official proceedings, and tampering with a witness. These offenses constitute RPC 8.4B and 8.4C violations, and the Office of Attorney Ethics agrees with the unanimous recommendation of the Disciplinary Review Board that respondent be disbarred. Respondent's conduct in the criminal matter undergirding this case was pervasive, shocking, and reprehensible. The OAE does not intend to go into the facts with any level of detail, as they have been outlined both very well in the Disciplinary Review Board's decision and in the Third Circuit criminal opinion in this case, as well as my own brief before the Disciplinary Review Board. But suffice it to say that from 2009 to 2013, respondent acted as basically a consigliere to the NICA organization, which was a sophisticated multi-state marijuana trafficking organization. And his activities in regards to that were the factual basis for the ultimate jury finding of guilt for the money laundering conspiracy, tampering and tampering with a witness and tampering with proceedings charges. He ran basically a legal defense fund for lower level marijuana dealers in the organization and used his attorney accounts to basically fund this legal defense fund using cash that was the proceeds of the illegal activities of the organization itself. He concealed the source of the funds. Again, the details of that are outlined pretty well in the Third Circuit opinion, but he also counseled some of the lower level dealers on the collapse defense theory. He basically made fairly overt threats to dealers that they, if they did not participate in the theory that he was putting forth, that they could come to physical harm. He counseled at least one of the drug dealers to forge affidavits that were to be submitted to the DEA, and directed his own legal assistant basically to act as a notary when she wasn't one, to notarize these falsified affidavits that eventually went to the DEA and eventually caused the DEA to forego the forfeiture proceedings in this case for a period of time. Basically, he also counseled one of the lower level drug dealers to tell federal law enforcement only what they already knew, basically to give false and incomplete information to the law enforcement officer and to lie by omission. Following the jury trial for those charges, he was sentenced to concurrent 42-month terms in federal custody, followed by 18 months of supervised release on each count. Thereafter, as I explained before, my office, the Office of Attorney Ethics, filed a motion for final discipline, which was reviewed by the Disciplinary Review Board, who voted unanimously to disbar respondent, noting that although he was not charged with personally distributing the drugs, he facilitated or helped facilitate a sophisticated drug distribution network. And I would direct the court to page 16 of the DRB's opinion for cases in support of disbarment generally for conspiracy to distribute narcotics and for actual distribution cases. The DRB, in its opinion, noted further that attorneys convicted of charges such as racketeering and witness tampering, bribery, are also routinely disbarred. So charges of that magnitude generally result in disbarment, not invariably, but generally, particularly in sophisticated conspiracies, they do result in disbarment. And the DRB cited cases on pages 16 and 17 of its opinion in support of that proposition, of that other basically line of cases that support disbarment here. The DRB then went on to note additionally, kind of taking a separate look at it, that attorneys who commit serious crimes, particularly a lot of serious frauds, that evidence a lack of moral integrity can be disbarred, and they're disbarred under the kind of the Goldberg factors in order to protect the public, the integrity of the bar, and the public's confidence in the legal profession. In summary, then, the DRB recommended unanimously respondents' disbarment, and the OAE supports this recommendation and has consistently argued for disbarment throughout the procedural history of this case. If there's no further questions, I rely upon the record below.
Thank you. Mr. Farrell.
May it please the court. Recent events have brought home Dr. King's frequent reminder that the arc of the moral universe is long, but that it bends towards justice. Moral change takes time and struggle. On January 10th, 1986, South Carolina decided that my client, James Terry Roach, was beyond forgiveness, unworthy to live, and in its electric chair took his life. For the prior 8 years, initially as an assistant professor at the University of South Carolina, I unsuccessfully struggled to persuade the U.S. Supreme Court, the Fourth Circuit, and the South Carolina state and federal courts that the United States Constitution's Eighth Amendment forbid my client's execution because he was 17 and mentally retarded at the time of the crime. 20 years later, a majority of the United States Supreme Court, in the cases of Roper v. Simmons and Atkins versus Virginia, agreed with me. Therefore, I painfully understand then and now Dr. King's lesson that moral change takes time and struggle. In 1970, I chose to go to West Point to defend America as a combat leader. 7 years later, as a third-year law student at Georgetown Law Center's acclaimed criminal justice clinic, I began a 40-year career defending America, but not as a combat leader, but as a criminal defense trial lawyer, defending one person at a time, often one unpopular person that the government sought to kill or send to prison for life without parole. Today, I face my professional death penalty from the New Jersey practice of law. I pray that it will not take 20 years for this court and its state to agree that no New Jersey lawyer should be beyond forgiveness and unworthy of the opportunity of a second chance. Contrary to what the Attorney General just averred, I did not lie, cheat, or steal, nor did any of my convictions involve misconduct before any court, but only involved crossing the law's line in our adversarial system vis-a-vis law enforcement and the Maryland Federal Prosecutor's Office. My conduct was always directed to assure the competent legal representation of young persons facing mandatory incarceration for minimums of 5 to 20 years for distributing marijuana, which is now recreationally legal in this state and 14 other states and our nation's capital. Moreover, the conduct for which I was convicted occurred while I was trying capital and non-capital homicides one after another for indigent clients in Philadelphia for the lowest compensation in America. My convictions and the Maryland federal prosecutor's decision to target me arose from my acceptance of cash, willfully blind that its source was from the sale of marijuana, and my openly sharing those funds, sometimes by check, with other lawyers to whom, because of conflicts, I was required to refer young persons who sought my legal assistance because they were subpoenaed and or subjects of the Maryland federal grand jury investigation and prosecution for distributing marijuana. The head of the ring and many of the co-conspirators had been clients of mine over the prior 15 years. Each defense counsel was to act pursuant to a joint defense agreement confirmed in writing. Not unlike Lord Brougham, the great British advocate from more than a century ago, some might opine that I was a good lawyer, but a bad citizen. In February of 2017, after a 14-day trial and 3 days of deliberation, a Maryland federal jury convicted me. In July of 2017, I was sentenced to 42 months in federal prison, served 28, and was released a year ago tomorrow. During my custody, I provided substantial, constitutionally protected jailhouse legal assistance to my inmate brothers. Presently, I review as a volunteer paralegal inmate claims of innocence for the Pennsylvania Innocence Project and serve the Camden homeless as a member of the Jesuit Ignatian Volunteer Corps. The great Roman Stoic philosopher Seneca wrote that there are no persons so severely punished as those who subject themselves to the whip of their own remorse. The whip of my remorse is significantly stained with my blood. Wisdom proclaims that suffering is a gift and the best teacher. I never imagined I would receive such bounty and education. I, in my humble way, will continue to struggle to advance moral change in solidarity with the poor and those unjustly treated until hopefully we meet again. I will now answer any questions the court might have on my specific conduct or as to any issue.
Any questions, anyone? Mr. Farrell, would you like to close your remarks?
I think it is important to understand exactly what my conduct was. In addition to my money laundering conduct, which I addressed in my preliminary statement, I tampered with an official proceeding when, while on a homicide trial, I received a call from my office asking what should they do. They could not reach a client whose federal forfeiture claim forms were due the next day or forever lost. And some of the forms were signed and some were not, and all needed to be notarized. Unbeknownst to me, the client was cooperating with the government and was only pretending when, during our sufficiently taped meeting, he asked me to represent him in the federal forfeiture action. In order to preserve my client's rights, I instructed my office to sign and notarize his signature on the forfeiture claim forms that he had not yet signed, notarize all, and FedEx all to the law enforcement agencies in order that they would be timely filed and his rights protected. They're the facts that support the tampering with the official proceeding. As to tampering with the government witnesses, pretend client, I advised him during our meeting, which was surreptitiously taped at the government's direction, that it was not necessary for him to disclose that the seized watch, the smallest item sought to be forfeited, had been received as a reward from his pot supplier. I told him because the claim did not contend that the watch was not the fruit of illegal activity, but only raised Fourth Amendment search and Eighth Amendment proportionality legal claims. Completely undisputed, there was nothing in the claims, in the body of the claims, that were in any way inaccurate or contended something that was false. The second count of tampering with a witness arose from my advice to my client, Ryan Foreman, who I represented for 3 years from a subpoena as a first witness to the grand jury in Maryland through his indictment and over government opposition, successfully obtaining his bail. However, because the government asserted that I had a conflict and opposed my continued representation, I had to advise him to go to another lawyer at the direction of the government, represented by his new Maryland lawyer. And while surreptitiously wearing a barbed wire, he came to my office seeking legal advice and monetary help with the fee for his new lawyer. He indicated his dissatisfaction with the new lawyer because he wanted him to plead guilty and cooperate against his longtime close friends. He outlined to me that he felt a conflict between protecting his own family, wife and child, and loyalty to his friends with whom he conspired to distribute marijuana. He did not want to be labeled a snitch for the rest of his life. This is a longstanding challenge in federal drug cases as well as state changes, because the only way to avoid the draconian mandatory sentences, 10 years in his case, was to provide substantial assistance to the prosecution of others, and in the eyes of the client, becoming a snitch. I suggested a middle strategy, which I had successfully used in prior cases and was not in any way inconsistent with the federal proffer agreements that other clients of mine had executed in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania. In this strategy, he would attempt to avoid being labeled for life as a snitch by agreeing to plead guilty in proffer. He would thoroughly prepare for the proffer by painstakingly reviewing all available discovery, which I offered to help him and his new attorney to do, so that he could share during the proffer with the government only what they already knew, which should be extensive.
Mr. Farrell?
Yes, sir.
Respectfully, and I don't want to interrupt you and not give you an opportunity to address the court, but I have to note that you didn't respond to the motion by the OAE. You didn't appear before the DRB. You didn't submit anything substantively to the court with respect to the findings in this matter. And you appropriately and candidly told us at the outset that you were not opposing disbarment in this case. Would you like to sum up your argument? This is not an appropriate forum for a lengthy discussion of what happened at trial and what happened in the criminal case.
Mr. Justice, I was simply responding, I think, to some factual averments by the disciplinary board. Your remarks are correct. The only thing I'd like to say in closing is that I opposed the death penalty as it applied to the taking of life. I opposed the death penalty as it applies to the taking of the license of a New Jersey lawyer who has served his clients and the courts of New Jersey well throughout his life and who will serve in solidarity the poor and the unjust victims of injustice in the future, and only ask, frankly, that the court consider my remarks in support of its consideration of changing the present status of the death penalty with respect to New Jersey lawyers in New Jersey.
Thank you.